And I guess we should leave this here. And very nice to see some old friends again. Mary Beth, Gabriel, that's really nice to see. So the purpose of this talk is to challenge the conventional belief that the Hamiltonian in quantum field theory has to be Hermitian. And in effect, what I'm going to be doing is extending quantum mechanics and also classical mechanics into the complex plane. You know, you extend the real number system into the complex plane to help you understand calculus better, and that's exactly what I'm going to do with quantum mechanics. So this is a research program that I started in 1998 with the publication of a physical review letter with my graduate student, Stefan Becher. And now this has become a rather active research area. And I might say a new paper appears on the web every few days, every day or two, actually. This area of research answers to the name PT symmetry. And basically, the point of this work is that a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian can describe an acceptable theory of quantum mechanics. Okay? So what do I mean by non-Hermitian Hamiltonian? Well, here are some examples. Let's see. So here's an example of a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. That's an I over there. Here is also a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian, as you'll see. And you notice that this has an upside-down potential, wrong sign potential. And here are the corresponding quantum field theories. And what I'm going to argue is that these are just special examples of non-Hermitian Hamiltonians which define a perfectly acceptable theory of quantum mechanics. And when I say perfectly acceptable, what I mean is that there is a real positive energy spectrum. The spectrum is bounded below. And furthermore, you have unitarity. Those are the two crucial things that I'm going to establish. This is hard to believe, but that's what I'm going to show you. So I should begin with a table of contents. That's my table of contents. However, the plane, I have to say, the plane ride was very bumpy coming into Toronto. And the pilot got onto the intercom and he said that the contents may have settled during shipping. So you'll have to be patient with me. OK, so this has now become a really active research area. In the last 3 years, there have been 5 international meetings, which to me is astonishing, absolutely amazing, with many people at each of the meetings. I mean, something on the order of more than 75 people per meeting. And there are actually 2 more meetings that are planned. There's going to be a meeting this summer in Bologna and a meeting next summer in London or Los Alamos, one of the two. This is a list of my co-authors. And as you can see, I published with everybody from A to Y. I'm looking to publish a paper with someone whose last name begins with a C, but I haven't got there yet. So then I can say I published with everybody from A to Z. This is a, rather than reading their names to you, here are some of my collaborators. I'll just show you their pictures. This is my student Becher, with whom I began this research project, and a bunch of other people. There's Michael Berry with his glasses sitting on his tummy. And lots of other people. And there are, by now, it's, I would like to give you a list of researchers, and it's all, as soon as I make a list, it's immediately out of date. These are people, other people who've been doing research in the field, but it has grown so rapidly that with multiple apologies, there are many, many, many important people who are omitted from this list, and I probably should be able to show that list because it's probably implied. In any case, I should also mention that I'm not the first person really to work on PT symmetry. There are 2 very famous people who worked on it before. The first was Ptolemy. He certainly deserves credit. And the second was P.T. Barnum. Both of them deserve credit. But they both died. They're dead now, and they died from conventional name, poison. All right, so here's the history of this crazy idea. I was visiting Saclay about a dozen years ago, and I was talking with Vassis, who was a very distinguished mathematical physicist, and he had been working with Zinjer-Stein on a problem involving the Liang edge singularity. Now, this is not a talk on the Liang edge singularity, but you may know that that singularity is described by a conformal field theory, and it is an I-phi cubed quantum field theory. And they were wondering whether or not if they wrote down a corresponding quantum mechanical theory, namely this IX cubed quantum mechanical theory, whether or not something interesting would happen. And so they did a few numerical calculations, and to their surprise, they found a few eigenvalues, just a few, and they found out that they numerically, at least, it appeared as if the eigenvalues were coming out to be real. And they didn't understand how that could possibly be true, because the Hamiltonian is complex. And so Vassis said to me, what do you think about this? Do you think it's possible that maybe all the eigenvalues are real, or a large number of them are real? And my immediate reaction at the time was, are you kidding? The way I see it, this theory is crazy, totally crazy. And in fact, I didn't work on it, on this problem at all. And it wasn't until many years later that I was sitting in a colloquium, an incredibly boring colloquium, not unlike this colloquium. And I was trying to find a way to escape, and so I had some scrap paper with me. And I said, I'll work on a problem. And I tried to think of some interesting problem to work on. And this problem, for no apparent reason, popped into my head. And I said, well, suppose that it might even be true that the eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian are real. If they're real, it must be because this Hamiltonian has a symmetry. So I said, well, wait a minute. It's kind of obvious that this Hamiltonian does have a symmetry. It is symmetric under space and time reflection. So it's symmetric under parity symmetry combined with time reversal. Okay. So remember, under parity symmetry, x changes sign. And under time reversal, I changes sign. And so this remains invariant under PT symmetry. So what I'm talking about is space-time reflection. If we extend this to four-dimensional space, what I mean is that let's reflect all four components of a position vector in Minkowski space. So I immediately wrote down the following. Let me just skip stuff. I wrote down the following Hamiltonian. Consider the Hamiltonian p squared plus x squared, which is the harmonic oscillator, times ix to the epsilon. And let's treat epsilon as a small parameter. Okay? If epsilon is regarded as a small parameter, then we can do perturbation theory in powers of epsilon. So I'm introducing a small parameter in an unusual way. Usually, you introduce a small parameter so as to multiply the term that is making your problem unsolvable. But now what I'm doing is I'm using epsilon to measure how nonlinear this term is. Okay? Why am I doing it this way? Because for all real values of epsilon, this Hamiltonian maintains its PT symmetry. Okay? Because under space and time reflection, I and x both change sign. So this Hamiltonian is invariant under PT for all real epsilon. Okay? Now what I'm going to do is expand in powers of epsilon. And by the way, this is a method that is very useful to solve any sorts of nonlinear problem. For example, imagine you had the Thomas Fermi equation. Here is the standard Thomas Fermi equation. It's a second-order nonlinear differential equation boundary value problem. Here are the boundary values. This is a very difficult problem. This problem has not been solved analytically, and it's also extremely difficult to solve even numerically because it's very unstable. But basically, if you impose the condition that y of 0 is 1, and you demand that the solution go smoothly off to 0 at infinity, the objective is to calculate the derivative at 0. And numerically, that is the derivative at 0. Well, if you want to solve this problem perturbatively, a very, very, very effective, powerful, simple way of doing it is simply to say, replace this Thomas Fermi equation by y prime prime equals y, that's linear, times y over epsilon, y over x to the epsilon. And epsilon, again, measures how nonlinear this problem is. You look for a solution in powers of epsilon. Of course, to leading order, it's trivial. And at the end, you set epsilon equals 1/2 in this perturbation series. And just on the back of an envelope, you can calculate the solution to the Thomas Fermi equation accurate to several decimal places, just like that. No problem at all. So what I did in this boring seminar was to calculate several orders and powers of epsilon. And to my absolute amazement, every single eigenvalue turned out to be real and positive. Okay, order by order and powers of epsilon. I was stunned. You can't imagine how surprised I was, or maybe you can. And I ran out of this cloakroom when it finally, mercifully ended, ran back to my office, got onto the computer, spent a little while, and generated the following graph. And what you see here is this. Here is epsilon on this axis. And here is the Hamiltonian p squared plus x squared times ix to the epsilon. Note that when epsilon equals 0 right here, what you see is the standard eigenvalues of the harmonic oscillator. 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, and so on. Okay? But as epsilon increases, what you see is that the eigenvalues are taking off. Okay? They're all real. They stay real for all values of epsilon. Okay? Absolutely astonishing. So here's the summary. What I'm telling you is, I'm standing here telling you, that the spectrum of this Hamiltonian, p squared plus x squared times ix to the epsilon, is discrete, real, and positive, and Faraday's symmetry is broken. That's what I'm telling you.
That includes the continuous spectrum?
There is no continuous spectrum. But we're going to have to talk about why that's true. There's no continuous, this is a discrete spectrum. There's no continuous spectrum for this model. Okay? And of course, this is quite surprising, as you pointed out, because here I am telling you that it's a repeat, okay? And you might say, hey, what about epsilon equals 2, for example? Because at epsilon equals 2, the Hamiltonian is p squared minus x to the 4. And you might say, that should have a continuous spectrum. But it doesn't. It does not have a continuous spectrum. And it has a real positive spectrum. And in fact, let me do a calculation on the blackboard here. Let me prove to you, let me give you a very short proof that if you have PT symmetry, the spectrum has to be real. Okay? So the proof would go something like this. Let's suppose that we have a Hamiltonian which has PT symmetry. What I mean by that is that the Hamiltonian commutes with the PT operator. Well, you know that if the Hamiltonian commutes with another operator, the two operators can be simultaneously diagonalized. And that means that if I find, an eigenfunction of the Hamiltonian, whose eigenvalue is E, then this will also be an eigenfunction of the PT operator. PT on psi is its, whatever its eigenvalue is, times psi. Okay? Now, remember that P and T commute, and P and T are both reflection operators, so P squared is 1 and T squared is 1. So let me attack this equation first, and it's very simple. I'll just multiply on the left by PT. Okay? And, of course, I'll multiply in here by pt times pt. That's just 1. Okay. Now, remember that T is an antilinear operator, and it changes I into minus I. And therefore, PT times lambda times PT is lambda star. But PT times psi is lambda psi. Okay? And PT squared is 1. So psi is equal to lambda star lambda psi. So the absolute value of lambda is 1. And therefore, the eigenvalues lambda of PT are pure phases, e to the I thetas. Okay? And this is true. The eigenvalues of the PT operator are e to the I theta. Okay, so now I'm half done. All I have to do is play with that equation. Okay, and all I'm going to do is multiply on the left by PT. And again, I'm going to insert in here the number 1, which is PT times PT. Okay, what else can I do? Well, on the right-hand side, PT times E times PT is E star. And PT operating on psi, we agree, is lambda star. And over here, PT commutes with the Hamiltonian. That's what you mean by saying that the Hamiltonian is PT symmetric. So I have H times PT times psi. But PT times psi is really lambda psi. And of course, H, the Hamiltonian, is linear. So it commutes with the number lambda. It's just a number. And when it operates on psi, it gives me E psi. So I have lambda times E times psi on the left, and E star times lambda times psi on the right. But I just argued that lambda in absolute value is 1, so it's not 0. So I can divide by it, and I conclude that E is equal to E star. Okay? So the eigenvalues must be real. And really, there's only one.
But that doesn't say there's no continuous vector.
No, it doesn't. We have to talk about it. But it does say that the eigenvalues are real. And there's only one problem with this proof. It's complete nonsense. It's totally wrong. Okay? And in fact, that to demonstrate that it's completely wrong, I want to go back and look at this graph that I just showed you before. What you saw was not what I just proved on the board. If you look at this graph, you see that when epsilon is positive, the eigenvalues are all real and discrete and positive. But when epsilon becomes negative, you see an interesting phenomenon happening. You see the eigenvalues as a function of epsilon coming together and becoming, right there, they're becoming degenerate. It's a twofold degeneracy. And then it disappears, and the eigenvalues disappear because they've become a complex conjugate pair. Complex conjugate pair. So this proof is wrong. In fact, that proof illustrates the dangers of drinking and deriving. Okay, what's wrong with the proof is not obvious. Do you see what's wrong with the proof? The proof is completely wrong. Because I said that if two operators commute, they can be simultaneously diagonalized. That's not true here, because the PT operator is not linear. This is true if the operators are linear, but PT is an antilinear operator. T is an anti-P is linear, but T is antilinear. And so you can't even use the word diagonalize. You can diagonalize a matrix, which is a linear operator, but you certainly can't diagonalize a nonlinear operator. Okay? So really, the question is this. If these two operators commute, that's our assumption, then is it true or not true that if you find an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, that equation, does it also follow that this eigenstate of the Hamiltonian is an eigenstate of the PT operator? Does this equation follow? And the answer is, sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. In most interesting cases, in fact, it does imply that. Okay, but this is not trivial. And of course, everything beyond these two equations that I wrote down, that's just algebra, that's correct. The question is, how do we establish the correctness of these two equations? And to establish the correctness of those two equations is very non-trivial. I will simply introduce a terminology here. I will say that if epsilon is greater than 0, indeed, These two equations are valid, although I haven't proved them to you. They are valid, and I will call that a region of unbroken PT symmetry. But if epsilon is less than zero, we have a region of broken PT symmetry. And so there are two different possibilities. You could either have a broken or an unbroken PT symmetry. And it's important when you study a particular Hamiltonian to determine which is which. Okay. By the way, I looked it up on the web. I was interested in the PT boundary, the region between those, the point between the two regions. There are thousands and thousands of hits on Google. The PT boundary is the greatest murder mystery of all time. It's the boundary between the Permian era and the Triassic era. This is when there was an extinction of 90% of species, you know, a great asteroid hit the Earth and so on. So this is one of those great extinctions. And this, the Triassic era, that's the beginning of the age of the dinosaurs. And I point out, by the way, that one of those dinosaurs was the pterodactyl. So, all right. So how do you prove that, in fact, from this equation, it follows that you get those two equations? Well, this is non-trivial. And except in a few cases, I do not know a short and general proof that works. There are many people who have written rigorously about these ideas, but the first people to come up with a complete proof were Dorey, Dunning, and Tetao from Durham. And their proof is a monster proof. It goes on for about 60 pages. It makes use of all of the techniques of conformal field theory. It makes use of the Baxter-TQ relation. Makes use of the monodromy group, the beta ansatz. This is very, very non-trivial stuff. So basically, if you walk around the streets of France, you see things like this on the street. Okay? But every once in a while, you'll see something like this. And that's an example of broken PT symmetry. So it occurs in real life. All right, so here's the point of this talk. To define the quantum theory, you specify the Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian tells you what the dynamics of the theory are, and it embodies the symmetries of the theory. And of course, the usual symmetries are in two types. There are continuous symmetries and discrete symmetries. The usual continuous symmetry is Lorentz invariance. That's a very physical symmetry. And the usual discrete symmetry of a Hamiltonian is H dagger equals H. And I don't regard that as a very physical symmetry, because H dagger, the usual definition of Dirac hermeticity, is transpose and complex conjugate. And this condition, of course, is a very nice condition. It was given to us by the mathematicians. And it guarantees that the energy is real. You certainly want the energy to be real. However, the point of this talk is that H equals H dagger is mathematically convenient, whoops, but physically obscure and remote. I mean, I understand the Lorentz group. That's a very physical condition. But I do not understand transpose and complex conjugate. That is an interesting condition, but it certainly doesn't sound physical to me. And I'm going to propose a much more physical discrete symmetry condition, which is that of space-time reflection symmetry. P and T are elements of the Lorentz group again. And so I would like to impose the condition that HPT is equal to H. Okay? And I'd like to examine that as a possible physical condition. And what I'm arguing is that there are two alternative ways. If you've got a real symmetric Hamiltonian, there are two, not one, but two alternative ways to complexify real symmetric Hamiltonians. One way to complexify a real symmetric Hamiltonian is to make a Hermitian. But a completely, well, self-adjoint, if you like. But Hermitian here, I'm saying Hermitian in the standard Dirac sense, I mean, which is a case of being self-adjoint. You're going to see self-adjoint is the more general word. Yes. And I'm going to argue that, in fact, these Hamiltonians are self-adjoint. But they're not Hermitian in the Dirac sense. So dagger here really means transpose and complex conjugate. Okay? And there are many, there's a multiple class, you know, there are many parameter class of such Hamiltonians. But you can also start with real symmetric Hamiltonians and make them PT symmetric. complex and PT symmetric. So here are a whole bunch of new Hamiltonians that you can consider to represent physical processes that people would have rejected in the past. But in fact, I'm going to argue that they're interesting and physical. Okay. So basically, having given you that as an introduction, here is an outline of my talk. Infantile attention getting. Let me be more serious. Here is an outline. So basically, what I'm saying to you is that it is possible, if a Hamiltonian has PT symmetry, for the eigenvalues of that Hamiltonian to be real. And there's a transition between a region of broken and an unbroken PT symmetry. And by the way, it's very interesting that this transition that I showed you is a this is the transition that occurs for this Hamiltonian at epsilon equals 0. Remember, at the point epsilon equals 0, that's where the Hermitian Hamiltonian lives. That's where you find the harmonic oscillator. So the Hermitian Hamiltonian sits right at the boundary between the broken and the unbroken PT symmetric region. Okay. And what I'm going to tell you, although I probably won't have time to show it to you in detail, is that this Hamiltonian has a transition at epsilon equals 0, not just at the quantum level, but in fact at the classical level theory. If you look at just the classical level, you will see this transition. Okay? All right, so now here's the crucial issue. The crucial issue is this. The spectrum is real. You can show it either numerically, or you can even try and make rigorous proofs that the spectrum is real. The question is, are we talking about quantum mechanics, or am I just showing you a bunch of cute Sturm-Liouville problems that happen to have real eigenvalues? That's the question, okay? And we didn't answer this until 2002, when we published a PRL on this problem. And we actually were able to understand for the first time that these PT symmetric theories are quantum mechanical theories. That means we have to show, we have to demonstrate unitarity. So what I'm going to do now is explain to you PT symmetric quantum mechanics in 9 easy steps. And I mean easy. Okay. So step one, you're walking down the street, and someone gives you this Hamiltonian. And he says, go. So what do? Well, the first thing you do is you write down the corresponding Schrodinger equation. And you have to impose the boundary conditions. Now, the boundary conditions, when epsilon equals 0, are taken to be the boundary, the usual boundary conditions on the real axis. And these boundary conditions at epsilon equals 0 are that the wave function goes to 0 exponentially on the real axis. In fact, if it goes to 0 exponentially on the real axis, like a Gaussian, then it actually goes to 0 in a wedge that contains the real axis, and these are called Stokes wedges. As epsilon increases, as soon as epsilon increases from 0, what happens is that these Stokes wedges begin to rotate downward. For example, the picture at epsilon equals 1 looks like this. So you can still write down the eigenvalue problem on the real axis. You can demand that the wave function go to 0 on the real axis, or anywhere inside of this wedge. When you reach a minus x to the 4 theory, the wedges, so that's epsilon equals 2, the wedges now look like this. So you can no longer quantize on the real axis. You must require that the wave function go to 0 exponentially inside of these wedges in the complex plane. Okay. Now, in fact, you can quantize on the real axis, and that has interesting implications for cosmological theories, and I'll mention that in a little bit. Okay. And as epsilon continues to increase, the wedges continue to rotate down, and by the time you reach epsilon equals infinity, the wedges become infinitely thin, and there's one wedge here that runs right along the imaginary axis, and another wedge here that is infinitely thin. And the quantization path runs up the imaginary axis and down. And there's a branch cut over here. So you solve the Schrodinger equation numerically for all real epsilon. And what you discover is, as I told you, that the eigenvalues are all real and positive. And you also discover numerically, if that's good enough for you, that the eigenfunctions, phi sub n, are also eigenfunctions of pt for all n. Okay, so you have pt on phi is equal to lambda phi, where, as I told you on the blackboard there, the absolute value of lambda is 1. And now I'm going to introduce a convention. I'm going to normalize the eigenfunctions so that pt on phi is 1 times phi. Okay, I have the freedom to do that because I'm solving a linear problem. And the way I do that is I simply replace the eigenfunction here on the blackboard by e to the minus I theta over 2 times phi. And if you do this, you'll see that under pt, under the pt operator, the eigenvalue is now 1. Okay. Now, why can we multiply the eigenfunctions? Because the eigenfunction, because quantum mechanics is supposed to be array space. And we don't really care about the phases of the eigenfunctions. There's no physics in that. This is a pure condition. It's a condition that I can make having no physics in it whatsoever. But I think it simplifies everything that I'll say from now on. Okay, so this is just a choice. It's just a convention. Okay? All right, so step two, the next question is, do we have orthogonality? And in order to answer the question of whether we have orthogonality, we have to guess what the inner product is with respect to which we have orthogonality. So in order to guess what the inner product is, we'll argue as follows. If we knew that H, if we knew that H was equal to H dagger, our inner product, you know, what do we mean by A dotted into B? Our inner product would be defined to be A dagger dotted into B. Okay, that's what we want. Well, I'm arguing that if H is equal to HPT, then what I mean by this inner product would be APT dotted into B. What I mean by APT is the PT operator operating on A, and then you dot that operator into that vector into the B vector. Okay, so this is a definition of what I mean by an inner product. Now, I don't know if that's the correct definition, but I can't think of anything else, so I will try it. And if I do use that inner product, I'm delighted to discover that if you dot the nth eigenfunction with the nth eigenfunction, you get 0 if n is not equal to n. So we have orthogonality. So that's great. That's progress. And here comes the problem. If we now calculate the inner product of phi with itself, okay, but this is an integral that's done along a contour that lies in these wedges, we dot phi with itself, it's not positive. That's the problem. That is the problem with this theory. In fact, we get minus 1 to the n.
So what is n?
N is the nth eigenvalue.
So you mean
half eigenfunction. So in other words, they alternate in sign just the way the parity eigenvalue alternates in sign. I mean, if you look at, say, the harmonic oscillator, the eigenvalue under parity goes plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. And as n increases, there's a regular oscillation. In this case, it is the norm of the eigenstate that has this regular oscillation. All right, so the PT norm is not positive. And the amazing thing is that this is not a disaster. We will simply continue on and see what happens. Okay?
So the norm of the difference of two adjacent eigenfunctions is 0, right?
The norm of two adjacent ones is 0, yes.
Yeah, so
yes.
So the your criterion for distinguishability is going to be orthogonality, not...
Well, I mean, what you're saying is if I dot phi n with phi n plus 1, I certainly get 0 under this norm.
If you dot phi n plus 1 minus phi n with itself,
with in that case, I would get 0. So yes, so it's certainly true. You're pointing out that I can have states of 0 norm, and that's terrible. Okay, this is terrible. So we don't have a Hilbert space. We don't want that. And furthermore, this is certainly not quantum mechanics, because in quantum mechanics, the key element, the central element in quantum mechanics is that you associate a probability, physical probability that you measure in the laboratory, with the dot product, okay, with the norm of a vector, okay? And it better be that probability is positive. So it looks like we have a disaster. But we're going to solve this problem. It's really very, very easy. Nevertheless, let me go on for a couple of steps. We can now ask, do we have completeness? And to see if we have completeness, we need to reconstruct the delta function. And I'm simply going to make an assertion without really spending any time explaining it. This is how you reconstruct the delta function. Now, usually, this term right here would be missing in a conventional theory of quantum mechanics. If you want to demonstrate that you have completeness, you simply sum over the eigenstates, the eigenvectors, you know, phi sub n of x, phi sub n of y, and you reconstruct the delta function. But for us to reconstruct the delta function, we need to have a minus 1 to the n here. And we have verified this result to lots of decimal places, 25 decimal places. Okay. And once you have that result, you can start playing with the usual, playing the usual games you do in quantum mechanics. You can reconstruct your operators. Here is a reconstruction of the parity operator. Here is the reconstruction of the Hamiltonian. You simply weight this delta function by E sub n. Here's the Green's function. You weight this delta function by 1 over E sub n. And you can show that the Green's function is the inverse of the Hamiltonian, because the Hamiltonian operating on the Green's function gives you delta. Okay? So you can play all of these games. And in fact, once you have the Green's function, you can calculate the spectral zeta function. And this is the spectral zeta function. It's the sum over the reciprocals of the eigenvalues. And you can calculate the spectral zeta function for this theory exactly. So here's the answer. Let me not show you that. But here is... Okay, so for this theory, p squared minus, and now I'm absorbing that x squared into this, here is the exact formula for the sum of the reciprocals of the energy eigenvalues in closed form. Okay, but the problem remains. What do we do with the fact that we have a, that when we calculate the dot product of two vectors, there's a 50-50 chance that it'll be positive or negative? Okay, well, we finally found inspiration in a fantastic paper that Dirac wrote. This is his Baconian lecture from 1941. It's in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And what Dirac said, it's absolutely wonderful what he said. He's a really funny guy. He said, negative energies and probabilities should not be considered as nonsense. They are well-defined concepts mathematically, like a negative sum of money. Okay? Which I think is fantastic. So what did he do? What Dirac did, in short, was to take... Oh, you want to read the rest of it? This is a really wonderful... he said...
Yeah, we don't want to listen to you.
Dirac is much more interesting than what I'm saying. What Dirac did, of course, was to take the square root of the D'Alembert and to construct the Dirac equation. And unfortunately, the solutions to the Dirac equation, half of those solutions have positive probability when calculated in a conventional way, and half of them have negative probability. Half have positive energy, and half have negative energy. And to solve that problem, he said, this is not a problem. We merely need to redefine the inner product. And he said, in order to redefine the inner product, we need to include charge conjugation. And he invented the charge conjugation operator, which led him to postulate the existence of the positron and so on. It's a wonderful, incredible piece of work. And so that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to say that we should construct something like Dirac's charge operator. And we're going to call it C, in honor of Dirac. And the definition of C is unbelievably simple. C will be the sum over the eigenfunctions without that minus 1 to the n that is used to obtain a delta. So what are the properties of C? Well, first of all, C squared is 1. That's trivial. P squared is also 1, but C is not equal to P. So in fact, we have 2 square roots of 1 in this theory. But the most important thing is that C is a linear operator that commutes with the Hamiltonian. And therefore, it can be simultaneously diagonalized. Unlike PT, C can be simultaneously diagonalized. And in fact, the eigenvalues of the C operator are minus 1 to the n. So, by the way, also, C commutes with PT, although C doesn't commute with P or T alone. Also, there is no C operator in standard real Hermitian quantum mechanics. As epsilon goes to 0, and you approach the harmonic oscillator, for example, the C operator approaches P, the parity operator. So there is no distinct C operator except in complex quantum mechanics. But what have we got now? We have three commuting operators, mutually commuting operators, H, PT, and C, and these all commute with one another. And H and C are observables. Okay. Now, finally, I'm going to construct the Hilbert space for you. The Hilbert space will be defined as all possible linear combinations, complex linear combinations, of the eigenfunctions. And now we know what the inner product really should be. It shouldn't be the PT inner product. It should be the CPT inner product. Why? Because every time the PT inner product is negative, it has a factor of C. And the eigenvalues of C are minus 1 to the n. And therefore, when you calculate the CPT inner product, it is strictly positive. And you can verify that the norm of any vector is strictly positive. And that vector is, you only get a zero norm if, and only if, that vector itself is the vector 0. So the novelty here is that we have a dynamically determined inner product. It is determined by the Hamiltonian itself. So the Hilbert space is actually determined by the Hamiltonian. So I'm doing backwards quantum mechanics here. Usually when we do quantum mechanics, we begin by saying, I specify the Hilbert space, then I specify the Hamiltonian operator in the Hilbert space, then I diagonalize the Hamiltonian. This is a bootstrap theory. In effect, what I'm doing is, first I specify the Hamiltonian, not knowing what the Hilbert space is, because I don't know what the norm is. And then I find what the Hilbert space had to be. Okay, so the time evolution operator for this theory is, of course, the usual one. It's just e to the iht. And the inner product is preserved. We have unitarity for a very simple reason. The inner product is the CPT inner product. But both C and PT commute with the Hamiltonian. And therefore, that inner product, that's the only, those are the only two operators that both commute with Hamiltonian, typically. And so therefore, this is the unique inner product. You have to choose this inner product if you want to have unitarity. Okay. And then, of course, there's one last bunch of things that you do when you do quantum mechanics, which I'm not going to talk about. You know, you have to talk about probability density and probability currents and the Ehrenfest theorem and definition of observables and the classical limit and all sorts of stuff. And all of these things follow automatically, but the principal result is that what you now have is a conventional quantum mechanics based on a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian operator H.
Wait, when you have the new inner product?
Now it is, of course, a self-adjoint. But you didn't know. You see, it's backwards quantum mechanics because you didn't know that it was self-adjoint until after you constructed the inner product that you need to use to make it self-adjoint. You need to do that construction.
Sorry, yeah. Can you have PT not invariant in this, which is PT invariant and it's still okay?
Can I have?
Is PT necessarily similar to the Hamiltonian?
Oh, can I have a CPT invariant theory that is not PT invariant?
Yeah,
maybe. But that's not, that would not be enough to conclude that the eigenvalues are real. I mean, of course, I don't know what your C operator is in this case. If I redefine C times P as a new P, okay, I mean, C, what you're saying is I have a CPT invariant theory. So why don't we just call this operator CPT invariant? And redefine that as P, because this is a linear operator and that's a linear operator. So this is some linear operator. And I will call that P, and what you're telling me is that you have a PT invariant theory. Okay, P could be the explicit parity operator, but it could just be some other reflection operator with the property that its square is 1. Okay, possibly. Okay. And then you'd still have to establish that there exists another operator, C, that is that you're working in an unbroken PT symmetric region, and that you still have another operator, C, which makes the theory into a conventional combination theory.
So, in other words, you start with the Hilbert space, and what you've done is you've found a way to project onto a general Hilbert space such that you get a positive norm.
Yes, yes, I think you can say it that way.
Okay. It makes sense that you can do this. Mm.
Okay, so the novelties, here's what I've been telling you, that we have a complex extension of conventional quantum mechanics. There is no C operator in ordinary Hermitian quantum mechanics. We have a dynamically determined Hilbert space, so we have a sort of roots space. By the way, C doesn't commute with P separately, so particles and antiparticles don't have to have the same pairs. Okay, if you want to think of C as being the C of particle physics, which is interesting because in the universe we do seem to have a baryon and an antibaryon asymmetry. But most interesting, we have lots and lots of new models. And can I just talk for about another 5 minutes or so? Just
to sure.
Okay. So I just like to, I mean, this is the basic idea behind what I'm telling you, and I just want to show you some of the, just very, very briefly, just give you a glimpse at some possible applications. I should mention that John has been finding some very interesting applications in cosmology, and I'll mention that. So basically, you've now had an introduction to this theory, and I'd like to give you an overview of my talk, because I think it's a pretty good summary of what I've said.
So are you saying that there's no conventional Hamiltonian that would give you the same spectrum?
No, there is a conventional Hamiltonian that would give you the same spectrum, and I can tell you how to construct it, although it is extremely not trivial to do so. Okay? If you'd like, here's the recipe. The recipe is, you take the C operator,
you can lift this platform.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Multiple
so, I can write on this. Yeah. So, you take the C operator and you multiply it by the P operator. And you can show that this operator is a positive operator. In fact, you can write it in the form E to the Q, where Q is a function of the dynamical variables. You know, I mean, if this were just one-dimensional quantum mechanics, it would be a function of x and t. Okay? And this, in fact, is actually a conventional Hermitian function of x and t. So q, where by Hermitian I mean transpose and complex conjugate. So q dagger equals q. And because this is a positive operator, I can take the square root of this operator, and the square root of it would just be 1/2 that. Okay? And I will define this operator to, I'll call it eta, if you like. Okay? And now I can construct a similarity transformation. I can take the Hamiltonian that we started with, that is PT symmetric, and I can multiply by eta inverse. And this is some new Hamiltonian. Let's call it Hamiltonian tilde. This Hamiltonian has the property that it is Hermitian in the conventional sense. That is, that H dagger, H dagger equals H, or H transpose complex conjugate is equal to H. However, constructing this H is very, very non-trivial, or to put it in a different way. Calculating the C operator is non-trivial. It can be calculated, we've spent quite a bit of time looking at various models where we've calculated that operator. What is interesting is that operator in quantum field theory turns out to be quite fundamental. In fact, it is a relativistic scalar. Okay, so it is the same in all frames of reference. P and T are not scalars. Okay, but C is a relativistic scalar. And So it is clearly a fundamental object. And we have, until, this is the part you'll like, until 3 weeks ago, or 4 weeks ago or so, we didn't know any simple example, except very trivial examples, where we could calculate this equivalent Hamiltonian that has the same spectrum as this Hamiltonian. We had no example. And now we have one. Just one. We have no others. But the one that we have is, for the Hamiltonian, h equals p squared minus x to the 4, that Hamiltonian, you can put in a couple of equals. This Hamiltonian, h tilde, happens to be p squared plus 4, x to the 4, okay, minus the square root of 2, there's a g here, 4g, okay, minus the square root of 2, square root of g, okay, times x. Okay, this is the equivalent Hamiltonian. This is in units where, of course, Planck's constant h bar is 1. But if you include Planck's constant, there is this term is proportional to Planck's constant. And so this is an anomaly. And what you see here is a parity anomaly. That is, this theory has broken parity. But you can't see that it has broken parity. The breaking of parity is only in the boundary conditions at infinity. Okay, these are not parity symmetric boundary conditions. Okay, under parity, remember, x goes to minus x. So if you take a point in this wedge, it goes up here. Then under time reversal, it goes into x star, so it goes down here. So these are PT symmetric. These here are PT symmetric boundary conditions, but not parity symmetric boundary conditions. Okay. Well, this Hamiltonian, so of course the classical theory doesn't know about those quantum boundary conditions about classically forbidden regions and things like this. Classical mechanics doesn't know about that. So it doesn't know about that boundary condition, and therefore when you impose that parity violating boundary condition, this anomaly appears. Okay. There's actually a little bit more to it than that. This is really quite subtle. This x is not really a coordinate variable. It is a momentum variable. This p is not really a momentum variable. It's a coordinate variable. Now, of course, there is a symmetry between momentum and coordinate. P and x are symmetric. How do we tell the difference? We tell the difference by performing time reversal. Because under time reversal, p goes to minus p, velocity reverses sign. But x goes into x. Well, under time reversal, this x here goes into minus x. So it behaves like a momentum. But nevertheless, you can write down the corresponding Schrodinger equation, minus d squared dx squared plus blah, blah, blah. Solve this on the real axis, and you will get out the exact eigenspectrum of this Hamiltonian here. This is very interesting because what it says is that we can do something about the Higgs particle. Okay. By the way, this has PT symmetry. We have never broken the PT symmetry. To see the PT symmetry, remember that x changes sign both under momentum and under time reversal, okay, because this is like a momentum. So this is PT invariant, this is PT invariant, that's PT invariant. So the Hamiltonian maintains its maintains its PT symmetry. Okay? So that's an equivalent to Hermitian Hamiltonian. Okay, now, I won't...
I mean, in principle, you can always construct H tilde once you have this inner product and know it's by the spectral theory.
Yes, but I don't know the C operator. I only know it formally. But the question is, do I actually know it?
I see. But then it's not clear that you would always get something that even has P squared plus a potential.
Oh, no, you're absolutely positively correct. Okay? This is an incredible and remarkable example, and we know of no other simple examples like this. None. For example, the Hamiltonian p squared plus ix cubed has all powers of p and all powers of x. It's incredibly non-local. So I can only calculate this thing perturbatively, but I certainly can't produce the closed form Hamiltonian for you. This is an exact result, and I know of no other results that come out exactly like this. absolutely astonished, and I never thought that we would see a simple example where we could right away see that the PT-symmetric Hamiltonian, the PT-symmetric complex Hamiltonian, which is this, and the real Hermitian Hamiltonian, which is this, and they have the same spectrum. Oh, by the way, you could also, if you like, you could include an X squared, you could include a mass term. And then what you get is a minus X squared over here. So this is a double well, an inverted double well. Okay. So what I was going to show you some 2x2 examples, but I won't take the time. But if you're interested in seeing a simple 2x2 example, say, I can show you. But I won't take the time now. But what I'd like to, in the last couple of minutes, I'd like to show you some applications and properties of these theories because they're fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Of course, there are lots of physical applications, industrial applications. Chrysler is now making a PT car, which is great. John F. Kennedy used to travel around in a PT boat. And I found, to my delight, this is amazing. One last example, I found that in St. Louis, there is a PT sex club, which I think is absolutely fantastic. There's only a few cities in the country where you can visit a PT sex club, but we have never been there. We evidently have a PT. I should go there, actually, and have my picture taken under the sign. All right, but in physics.
You can tell NSF that that's among the broader implications.
Yes, this is certainly, an important industrial application. We want physics to lead to money-making applications. So if you go back to the 1950s, there are many, many examples. So this is just a small selection. If you go back to the 1950s, my old thesis advisor, T.T. Wu, wrote one of his monster papers, one of his tour de force type papers, in which he quantifies a system of interacting hard spheres. This was an incredible calculation. It actually calculated the ground state energy exactly, got the answer. And he conjectured, and he got a real number, of course, and he conjectured that the entire spectrum remained real and so on. The problem was that his Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian that he used, was non-Hermitian. And that's because in order to solve the problem, he converted to polar coordinates. And there's a problem with polar coordinates at p equals 0. You know that the p operator is p sub r has complicated is a complicated structure, and his Hamiltonian was strictly not Hermitian. And so he was criticized. How could you possibly get a real spectrum if your Hamiltonian is not Hermitian? And there was no answer to that. So the paper sits in the literature, and it was severely criticized. Well, the answer to the problem is now clear. If you go back and look at his Hamiltonian, it's actually PT symmetric, which is very nice. Simple result. In the 1970s, there was a whole industry of people doing what is called Region field theory. These are people who study the Pomeron, they study the high energy behavior of physics, and I'm sure Gabriel is an expert on this sort of stuff. And basically, there's many people who've done it. This is a very incomplete list. But if you look at what the Region field theory is, it's an I-phi-cubed field theory. And this field theory is not Hermitian. And the people knew that the states that they were calculating numerically were real. But on the other hand, these states, these are states of the non-Hermitian field theory. It's obviously a non-unitary theory, and so this business eventually died because there was no answer to the criticism that this is not an acceptable physical theory. But in fact, it is an acceptable physical theory. This is a PT-symmetric quantum field theory. It not only has a real positive spectrum, but it also is a unitary theory. It's a perfectly acceptable theory. And in fact, people are now getting back to work. I just spoke with one of the guys, Rich Brower. I just gave a talk on this last week at BU. And Brower tells me that he's absolutely delighted. And they have actually been writing more papers on Region theory and updating it. And they're talking about Region theory in de Sitter space and so on. So the industry is picking up again. In the 1970s and 1980s, there was another industry of people studying what was called the Liang edge singularity. And again, it turns out that now you have to talk about a conformal Phi Q theory. And if you read these papers, you read the papers of Cardi and Lusardo and so on, even in the abstract, of paper after paper after paper, it says in the abstract, we apologize, I'm roughly quoting the abstract, well, we apologize for the fact that these theories, this theory is not Hermitian and certainly not unitary, but, and then they go on and do their analysis. Well, in fact, their work is perfectly valid and justified because this is a PT symmetric theory, even though it's not Hermitian.
Sorry, misunderstanding, but I thought the CFP that corresponds to the CVM from Mingle model has the centers are less than zero, but it is non unitary.
Yeah. If we have a Yang-Mills theory.
No.
What?
The,
I'm sorry.
CFT that corresponds to this.
The conformal field theory that. No, the conformal field theory. Well, what I've shown you is that the conformal field theory is not Hermitian and not unitary if you use the Hilbert space in which you take transpose and complex conjugate. But what I've shown you is that you can construct a C operator. C operator exists and is a Lorentz scalar in such a theory, and we've constructed it perturbatively. And using that operator, now using the correct inner product, bang, the theory is a perfectly acceptable quantum theory. It is self non Hermitian, but it's self adjoint. The Hamiltonian, we have unitarity, we have everything. It's a fully acceptable quantum theory. So all their self criticism is not justified. These are wonderful pieces of work, and they stand as being correct.
But is the physical theory that you're defining that way the same as the theory they're studying?
Positively. Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. The reason, let me tell you why. Because it's an I-Fi-Q, you could ask that question, and the answer is not always yes. But you see, the key point is that for a Phi-Q theory, I showed you that these Stokes wedges include the real axis. So I do not have to go off the real axis to justify these calculations. So there's a simple transcription, the functional integral you write down converges, everything works. Okay, there's no difficulty whatsoever. Okay. In the 1980s, there was a whole series of papers written by Tim Holloway and also Dave Olive, David Olive contributed to this too. And these papers were on complex total lattices. And these people were stunned to find that the eigenvalues of a complex total lattice are real. Well, they didn't know why, but they discovered numerically that they were real. Well, in fact, the explanation is really simple, really simple. It happens that these complex total lattices are PT symmetric. And finally, just very recently, Anton Zeilinger has been doing experiments with PT symmetric non-Hermitian Hamiltonians with periodic potentials. Michael Berry likes to call this a complex diffractive ring. And in these experiments, if you're interested, I'll tell you about this afterward, because there are tabletop experiments that you can do to verify that you have physical theories that you can construct, a physical apparatus, which is described by a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. And if you're interested in condensed matter physics, these periodic potentials, complex periodic potentials, have bands and gaps and so on, and they behave in just the usual and expected way, except for one or two characteristic features which are different from conventional band theory. It's very interesting. Okay. But there are lots of interesting models, and I think maybe one of the most interesting is the Higgs sector. Normally, you would like to describe the Higgs sector by a G phi to the 4 theory. But this theory is not asymptotically free. So in fact, such a theory, at least in the Higgs sector, is trivial. Okay? However, if you write down a minus G phi to the 4, the expectation value of phi is non-zero, and you can see that it's non-zero because you have a linear term in here in the equivalent. And you have a dimensionless coupling constant, and this theory is asymptotically free. So contrary to popular opinion, you can construct asymptotically free field theories that do not have a Yang-Mills type structure. You can just construct scalar theories or theories with abelian gauges, which are asymptotically free. So an example of a theory that has an abelian gauge that is asymptotically free is PT symmetric quantum electrodynamics. And what is interesting about this theory is that, if you remember a long time ago, Gell-Mann and Lowe introduced the notion of the Gell-Mann-Lowe eigenvalue, which was a fixed point in electrodynamics. And that fixed point was determined by the theory itself. So in other words, the idea was that you would have quantum electrodynamics that would determine its own value of alpha, 1 over 137. Well, it didn't work. And the reason it didn't work is that the theory doesn't have a fixed point, and that's because ordinary electrodynamics is not asymptotically free. But this theory is PT symmetric electrodynamics, is asymptotically free. And the idea introduced by Casimir, for example, for determining the value of alpha works. You can calculate it. It doesn't come out to be 137, but you can calculate it. It comes out to be 0.08 something or other. And we did the calculation. It works. Furthermore, you can study the bound states in a minus G phi of the four theory. They have a remarkable property. A G phi of the four theory is a repulsive theory. Two particles feel a repulsive force. If you write down the beta saltpeter equation, you'll find no bound states because there's a repulsive potential. But a minus G phi of the four theory is an attractive force. And so if you solve the beta saltpeter equation, you'll find bound states. And you'll find, for example, a state of two particles, bound state of two particles. But what is remarkable about the theory is that as you increase the value of G, these bound states at first become more tightly bound. Binding energy becomes bigger and more negative. Okay? But as G continues to increase, the bound states fall apart, which is very interesting. So there's an instability in the theory, and eventually the bound states fall apart. And actually, they're not just states of two bound particles, but three, four, five, six, and so on. You could call this exotic bound states if you want. And as you increase the coupling constant, first the 10-particle bound state falls apart, and then the 9-particle, the 8-particle, the 7, and there's a cascade until there are no more bound states left. Okay, at a value of G, which is roughly equal, on the order of 1. Okay, so in fact, there's a range of G for which you can have bound states of 3 particles and bound states of 2 particles, but no other bound states, just like quarks. Very interesting dynamics. Okay, and you can even write down a PT symmetric gravity theory. You can just write down a spin 2, coupled spin 2 theory, couple the spin to the stress tensor, and what you find is that unlike in conventional gravity, you now have a repulsive force, okay, which is kind of interesting. Maybe, possibly, you might explain something about dark matter. And furthermore, there's some recent work on ADS, on the ADS-CFT correspondence, kind of interesting. And the statement is this. Can you study a PT symmetric P squared minus GX to the 4 theory? Well, in fact, you can quantize this theory just on the real axis by imposing the condition. So if you're on the real axis, you have an upside down potential. But you can impose as a quantization condition the statement that an incoming wave on the left does not reflect. Okay, so of course, if you had a negative energy, if you had a wave approaching the potential with a negative energy, you would definitely have a reflective wave. You cannot require that the potential be reflectionless. You can't do that for a negative energy. But for a positive energy, if you have an incident wave coming this way, the wave will pass over the potential, but there will be an exponentially small reflected wave. All right? Well, if we require that there be no exponentially small reflective wave, then we find that that is a quantization condition that gives precisely the energy spectrum of a minus of a p squared minus x to the 4 theory. That's where that spectrum comes from. Okay? Well, the reason why this may have some interesting applicability in the DS-CFT correspondence is that in the Sinner space, you have some sort of 5-dimensional space, and our universe is propagating through this space. And if you read various papers by Witten and Horowitz and so on, you can think you can make a one-dimensional approximation to this. And what it looks like is that this four-dimensional universe, where you have some sort of holographic image on the surface, this universe is propagating as if it's in a minus x to the 4 potential, or minus x to various upside-down potentials like this. Okay. Well, we would like our universe not to shatter. This is an upside-down potential. We don't want it to shatter into multiple universes, one universe scattering backward into sitter time and the other one going forward into sitter time or something like this. So if we want to have a reflectionless propagation through the sitter space, that would give us a quantization condition just with positive energy levels like this. And it is possible that the lowest eigenvalue that you get is precisely the way to determine the cosmological constant. That's the ground state of such a universe. Okay, so that's a sort of physical condition. Okay, and let me give you just one last illustration. Take just a minute. I have to do this because the title of this talk was Ghost Busting. Okay, so now let me explain to you what I mean by ghost busting. And I just mentioned something, a very, very famous paper that was written by T.D. Lee back in 1954. It's called the Lee Model. And it's a beautiful theory. It's a three-point interaction where you have a V particle, this is like a proton, that turns into a neutron, an N particle plus a theta particle. Okay, and of course you have a neutron and a theta particle combining into a V. And the reason why this is a soluble model, Lee's idea was, let's eliminate crossing symmetry to make the model soluble. And he did. And that's a wonderful idea. And when I say soluble, what I mean is that you can completely renormalize this model in closed form. You can calculate, you can do the mass renormalization, coupling constant renormalization, wave function renormalization, it can all be done. The problem is, it only took a year. A year later, Shalane and Pauli wrote a classic paper that demolished the model. What they showed is that this model has ghost states. And the reason that the model has ghost states is very easy to see. What you see is this. If you calculate the unrenormalized coupling constant squared as a function of the renormalized coupling constant squared, this function starts at zero, of course. But then if the renormalized coupling constant, the thing you measure in the laboratory, as it increases, the unrenormalized coupling constant gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Here is the three-point interaction. Okay? And then it comes up from minus infinity, and it stays negative. Well, if g naught squared is negative, then g naught is pure imaginary. So we have a three-point coupling with an imaginary g naught. This is really I. And that's a disaster because the Hamiltonian is obviously not Hermitian. Okay, that's it. That's the problem. And so there are ghosts. And lots of people wrote many, many papers on non-Hermitian quantum mechanics. Pauli, Wick, Shalane. I found at least 20 famous people who wrote papers. Sudarshan wrote papers. Yeah, all sorts of people wrote papers on non-Hermitian quantum mechanics. And basically, there was no resolution to this problem. A ghost seems to be inevitable in this theory. It's a disaster. And in fact, I'll just read to you. I must read to you what, if you get out the book by Barton, this is what Barton says. I guess it doesn't fit. Well, it doesn't fit on the screen. Now it fits. So what Barton said was, a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian is unacceptable. Partly because it may lead to complex energy eigenvalues, but chiefly because it implies a non-unitary S matrix which fails to conserve probability and makes a hash of the physical interpretation. That's it. The Lee model is dead. No, it isn't. It's not dead at all. In fact, we wrote an elementary paper explaining that it wasn't dead. In fact, the problem is solved. And the solution is this. As the coupling constant gets stronger and stronger and stronger, you reach a critical point where the unrenormalized coupling constant becomes pure imaginary. It doesn't matter. That's perfectly okay, because now you have an I-phi cube theory, in effect. And this theory, while it is not Hermitian, has undergone a transition to becoming a PT symmetric theory. So we constructed the C operator, and I'll just show you the C operator. We were, in this theory, this is unusual, but because this is a soluble theory, this is the exact formula for the C operator. And so this theory has been ghost-busted. Okay, here's the exact formula for the C operator. I won't let you focus on that for a long time. But anyway, we calculated it in closed form, and now the theory is a perfectly consistent particle theory, a model of particles, if you like. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with the theory. The ghosts have gone. And in fact, if you now recalculate the inner products in the theory, everything is positive, the scattering works, the S matrix is unitary, no problem whatsoever. Okay? So basically, here's my concluding comment. My conclusion is I'm very excited about PT symmetry. I haven't had this much fun doing physics since I started doing physics. And the reason I'm having so much fun is that essentially everything I do works. You sit down and you say, hey, what about this model? And a few weeks later, you have a paper. It's unbelievable. Anything that you're an expert in, if you're an expert in anomalies, if you're an expert in the beta-saltpeter equation, if you're an expert in whatever, all you have to do is study what you already know in the context of a PT symmetric theory, and bang, you've got a paper. Well, John is an expert in cosmology. He looked at a PT symmetric 5^4 model and played around with non-Hermitian Hamiltonians and came out with a very beautiful paper in Physics Letters. And this is what has been happening over and over and over again to people who have worked in this theory, and that's why there's so many people who are playing around. It's astonishing to me, for example, that the Hamiltonian that describes the wandering of the Earth's magnetic pole happens to be non-Hermitian, but it's PT symmetric. I mean, these things pop up all over the place. I know nothing about the wandering of the Earth's magnetic pole, but I was delighted to see that this happens to work even there. Okay, so thanks very much for listening.
You have a model where there are two space dimensions.
In other words, quantum mechanics, but 2 degrees of freedom. That's what you mean.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. You can write down, for example, you could write down, instead of an ix cubed, you know, say p squared plus ix cubed, you could just as easily write down, say, p squared plus q squared, two momenta.
Yeah.
And then have and you could put in a mass term if you like, plus x squared plus y squared if you like. And then you could put it in an interaction of the form, say, I x squared y. And that's a PT symmetric theory. You can even make and models like this are complex Hanon-Hiles potentials.
Oh really?
Yes. So these are complex Hanon-Hiles potentials. One interesting problem that has not been solved is to study the quantum chaos that you observe. You know, as you know, the people who study chaos use models like this. And the advantage of this is that now you have a real positive spectrum. Okay, this is an unbroken PT symmetry. You can calculate the spectrum numerically. You can study distributions of eigenvalues. This is an unpublished problem. If you're good at calculating eigenvalues, you could do it in an afternoon. If you're not, you could do it in a week.
I see.
You
worked it out. Isn't it?
Yeah, we calculated a few eigenvalues, but in fact, we haven't published it. I mean, we don't know what the spectrum, I mean, to see if you have quantum chaos, what you have to look at is the spectrum is of thousands of eigenvalues. And you have to compare to see what kind of distribution these eigenvalues satisfy. It's actually not the eigenvalues, but the differences between the energy levels. And you have to see what kind of distribution, whether it's Maxwellian or whatever.
Yeah.
And that provides a diagnostic to see if you have quantum chaos. And there's an example of a model for you. You can have 3 degrees of freedom if you like. Very nice.
No,
you can have I, X, Y, Z. Like that.
And how about classical mechanics? You made some comment at the beginning.
Oh, yes. The classical mechanics is absolutely, let's see, I don't want to fool.
You pulled this one out.
No, it's also one of the
I can go.
Look, it's one you can pull down.
I know, I pull it.
One underneath the top.
I'm not quite sure.
I am. Even our shorties can do something once in a while. Okay, so, so the classical mechanics is fantastic. Okay? The point is, when I explain it, I just say this. If you were giving a first-year undergraduate course in physics, elementary physics, the first thing you would teach your class is consider the Hamiltonian p squared plus x squared, you know, the harmonic oscillator. And you would say, what do the solutions look like? Well, you would say, this is the energy. The turning points are where p is equal to 0. So the turning points are at x plus or minus equals plus or minus the square root of p. So you'd say, if I give a particle an energy E, so here's x equals 0, here's the square root of E, here is minus the square root of E. If I release a particle from this turning point, it speeds up and goes to the other turning point. It stops, turns around, goes back again. And classically, that's what you see. Okay? It's very simple. And also, the point is that this is Hooke's law. The force is the negative derivative of the potential, so the force goes this way, and the force goes this way, and so on. So you have periodic motion. And a student walks up to you after class and says, what if you put the particle over here to start with? And you say, you can't do that. That's not allowed, because if you put the particle here, then x is bigger than the square root of e. So x squared is bigger than e, so p squared here is negative. How could p squared be negative? And your student says, no problem. If p squared is negative, p is imaginary, so the particle is going that way in the complex x plane. Okay? So if you then solve the equations of motion, it's trivial. What you find is that you get an ellipse. Okay? This is a Keplerian ellipse, and the foci of the ellipse are precisely these turning points. And no matter where you start the particle, say here or anywhere you like, you have all this family of ellipses, and the ellipses fill all of space. This is a space-filling family of ellipses. Okay? By the way, the amount of time it takes, the period of the motion, is always the same. Okay, so the time to go around this ellipse equals the time to go around that ellipse. And the original classical motion is actually a degenerate ellipse. It's an ellipse with no, no epsilon, no epsilon. The semi-minor axis is zero, whatever, semi-main. So this is actually, there's a branch cut connecting the turning points, and this is going above the branch cut, infinitesimally, and below the branch cut, and so on. Okay? So what we have here is a complex atom where the particle remains bound. And it's interesting because on the imaginary axis, y here is equal to ix. So y squared is minus x squared. So the potential is going down in the imaginary direction. So there's a force that way and that way. So why doesn't the particle fall off to infinity? The answer is for the same reason that we don't fall into the sun. Well, we are falling into the sun, is the point. We're in a bound orbit. And we're not falling into, we don't get any closer to the sun, even though we're in free fall. We're falling toward the sun. There's an unbalanced force. Here, there's an unbalanced force going outward, but the particle classically does not fall off toward infinity. And now the last step is, so what I've done is I've extended this one simple, trivial classical orbit on the real axis to all classical orbits in the complex x-plane. So I've looked at all of the solutions of the equation f equals ma. Okay, I've solved Newton's laws in the complex plane. And there are many more interesting solutions. Now, for any solution, you pick any one you like. If you do Bohr-Sommerfeld, if you write down, you know, the integral of p dx and set that equal to n plus a half pi, you get the eigenvalues of the harmonic oscillator. And for the case of the harmonic oscillator, you get them exactly. So this is leading order WKB. Okay? Well, now, if you simply multiply this by ix to the epsilon, and you increase epsilon, all that happens is that these ellipses distort topologically. So for larger epsilon, These turning points rotate downward into the complex plane. If you release a particle at this turning point, a classical particle, it goes over here and comes back again. It goes back and forth like this. But if you start a particle somewhere else, you get a distorted ellipse like this. Okay. And again, if you write down this quantization formula, out pop the eigenvalues. Notice, by the way, the ellipses have left-right symmetry. That's the PT symmetry. Okay. What happens in the broken PT symmetric region is that you don't get atoms, complex atoms. If epsilon goes negative, the turning points now rotate into the upper half plane. And if you release a particle from the turning point, what it does is it goes up like this and it goes right toward the other turning point. And the amazing thing is it misses. It doesn't hit the turning point. And it keeps going around and around, and eventually it goes up to infinity. So you don't have a complex atom. You still have PT symmetry. That is, if you were to start a particle from this turning point, it would go around the other way. Okay, so you still have a left-right symmetric picture. But now you don't have closed periodic orbits. You have open orbits. And therefore, you can no longer write down this quantization formula. And that's why you don't have real eigenvalues. That's the underlying transition between the broken symmetry region and the unbroken symmetry region. And the classical mechanics of this is astonishing. And you could even get, the structures that you get just in the classical topological pictures you get of the classical paths. We just wrote a paper on it, and the paper has almost no words. It has 38 figures or something like this. It's on the net. They're beautiful, amazing figures that you get, just astonishing structures that you get.
What about the Phi-Kip theory, which is
an ordinary Phi-Kip theory, without the eye. Without the eye. Yes. I'll make one remark about that, because I think if you said to me, what is the most interesting aspect of how does this stuff really work? By looking at a Phi-Q theory, you can understand what the mechanism is that I've been talking about. And it's amazing, I think. The point is this. If you have an ordinary, say, G Phi-Q theory, okay? And you calculated the ground state energy density in this case. Not ground state energy, but energy density. Okay? You need to sum up all of the graphs, that are, the vacuum bubble graphs, a graph like this or a graph like this, okay, in the G Phi Q theory. Okay, and then you have G to the 4 graphs and G to the 6 graphs and so on. So the ground state energy density as a function of G is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, you just write it down, A sub n times G squared to the n. The point is that in a Phi-cube theory, all of these A's, if you calculate the Feynman diagrams, painstakingly, graph by graph, you'll find that every AN is strictly the same sign. And therefore, this series, which is divergent, is not Borel summable. And if you perform a Borel summation, it's not Borel summable in the sense that if you sum this up, in the complex G squared plane, there will be a branch cut over here. And because there's a branch cut, there's a discontinuity. The discontinuity is the imaginary part of E, and the imaginary part of E corresponds to the lifetime of the state in this theory. Okay, so the potential, looks like this. And you put a state in here, and it tunnels through, and it goes off to infinity. And that's the reason why the energy is complex. Okay? That's the reason why it's not bounded below. It's because this potential is not bounded below, right? How does what I'm telling you work? The way it works is that if you now make this an IG Phi-Q theory, then this G squared changes sign, so you have minus 1 to the n. It's now Borel summable. This branch cut rotates over here in the G squared plane. Okay, so now the discontinuity across the cut is zero. The imaginary part of the energy disappears, and that's the reason why the eigenvalues are all real. There's no branch cut. Okay?
And
it's bounded from below. But here, there's one more remark And this is the thing that, if you ask me, what is the most, the single most interesting thing you've ever seen in your life? That's what I'm going to tell you. Okay? This is really it. If you, you see, this is a nice, compact, simple argument. So the question is, what if we study, say, a G5 to the fourth theory? So you add up the graphs, and the energy is a sum of A sub N and G to the N. That's the ground state energy. Okay? This is a conventional G, positive G5 to the fourth theory. How does it work? Well, these A sub N's naturally alternate in sign. These graphs go like minus 1 to the N. Okay? But I told you that I could write a minus G5 to the fourth theory. And if you now go back and recount, if you change the sign of G, this alternation is canceled off. Now it's not Borel summable, because it's not alternating in sign. So if I calculate the discontinuity across the cut, there is an exponentially small, but imaginary part. Because, you know, now on the real axis, the potential looks like this. And if you put a particle in, you know, in some state in this potential, it tunnels out, goes off to infinity. And the imaginary part of the energy looks like e to the minus 1 over g times something or other. It doesn't matter. Okay? So there's a non-perturbative discontinuity across the cut. And that looks like what I've been telling you is nonsense. The way this theory works, the mechanism is, of course, we know we have a rigorous proof that tells us, no, no, the energies are real. This proof is rigorous, what I've said to you today. The energy levels are all real, strictly real. There are no complex energy levels. The way it works, however, from the physicist's point of view is, you see, this is just the perturbative contribution to the energy. You have to include non-perturbative contributions, instanton contributions. And when you include, order by order, in powers of G, the instanton contributions, you get minus that. And there is an exact cancellation between the non-perturbative contributions and the discontinuity you get by performing a Borel summation of the perturbative contributions. They exactly and precisely cancel. This is not an approximate statement. It's exact to all orders of perturbation. And that's how this thing works. I have to tell you, that is the most beautiful mechanism. I mean, that's the mechanism behind this,
well,
this stuff.
The reason I'm asking this is because if you try to construct a string field theory, mm-hmm. there's a proof I've written around 86. Such a theory is always a finite theory. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's from below. This is why you can't construct second quantum size string field theory. Mm-hmm. If you use this mechanism, I've been looking into this, if you use this mechanism, possible to construct string field theory, which is stable.
That would be
because if you want to get the string theory, you want to get off the mesh shell. You can't do that with standard string theory. You want to make it into field theory. And this has been an abstraction for years.
Well, if this could be used as a mechanism or as a trick, you know,
yeah.
that would be truly wonderful.
Get it into the complex thing.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.